Hi, this is Karen Rausch, and I'm the Clinical Managing Editor here at the American Journal of Nursing. And today I'm talking with Dr. Eileen Tohill, who's Associate Professor at Seton Hall University, and Marianne McCabe, who's the Director of Quality and Accreditation for the Visiting Nurse Association Health Group. We're going to talk today about their article on celiac disease, a medical puzzle. Hi, Dr. Tohill and Marianne.
Hi.
Hi.
Welcome, and I'm glad you're taking the time to talk to us. This is a really important topic, and one we're hearing more and more about, it seems, nowadays. And I was wondering, what triggered you to write this article?
Well, this is Eileen Tohill. When I was diagnosed, and I think about back to it, I was sick for so many years and trying to find out what was wrong. And when I finally found out what it was, Marianne really helped me to understand the diet and kind of cope with the diet. And little by little, more staff started coming out and talking about how their journey on to being diagnosed with celiac disease and how so many of them had struggled to understand why they were sick all the time or why they were having these weird symptoms that never seemed to go away and nobody seemed to know what it was. So,
other nursing staff?
Other nursing staff, mm-hmm. Absolutely. And then also, as I talked to professionals, you know, different professionals, nurses and doctors, I've had more than probably a half a dozen, eight or nine. I thought that was a disease that only affects children.
Mm-hmm.
So although it's been around and known for a very long time that this does affect adults as well, many professionals put it out of their mind and don't even think about it when they're assessing a patient unless it's a child. So that's really what I think led us to think about this.
And Karen, this is Marianne. On a personal level, my husband had been diagnosed probably 15 years ago where you hardly heard about celiac disease. And we were very fortunate, and he presented actually with anemia. And he went for testing. He was referred to a GI specialist in the area. And because that physician took the time with him and asked him many, many questions, did a really comprehensive history and physical on him, he actually, at that point, I remember him saying, I think I know what's wrong, but let's go ahead, do some blood work, we'll have you scoped, and just to confirm this. My husband has a very vague family background, both parents being deceased, and he was an only child, so it was hard to really pull from the history. But sure enough, he was diagnosed with celiac disease, and within 6 weeks being on the diet, I was married to a different person. He started to gain weight, he looked very good, he looked healthy, his blood work was coming back. So it was very interesting. What we didn't realize at the time was how challenging the diet was and to keep on it. So it's really gotten so much better over the last 15 years as far as our choices, as far as people being aware of what the disease actually is, and also the availability of nurses being aware and registered dietitians. To help with dietary choices. We don't just have to go to a health food store now. We can actually go into a ShopRite or a supermarket and find some of the items at a better price to use. So, and then, of course, it was very interesting also with my family, we were also watching our son. And sure enough, at the age of 17, he started to present with weight loss and having difficulty concentrating in school. And because of our awareness of celiac disease, we had him tested, and sure enough, he also had celiac disease.
So that is one of the risk factors, is family history.
Oh, yes. And I have a sister who was diagnosed 2 years ago, presented with lactose intolerance, and she insisted with her GI specialist to be tested for celiac disease. And at that point, they actually had genetic testing. So she actually surprised the GI specialist when it came back positive for celiac disease. So she is also on a gluten-free diet. And then myself, I actually presented with Hashimoto, and that's why I got tested. So we all presented very differently.
Right.
So many
symptoms. That was one of the things I noticed that I found when I read the article interesting is the broad range of symptoms that people can present with, and you can see why it might be hard to really, you know, pinpoint this diagnosis.
It's very difficult, and, you know, you'd be surprised. Like, one of the symptoms that I had, I used to have terrible migraine headaches and insomnia, and since I've been on the diet, I haven't had those, except recently I went to communion because they didn't have wine, and I just had a little tiny bit of the wafer. I had a migraine headache for 3 days, and then I got herpes all inside my mouth. So even, you know, going back on off the diet for just a very short time for some people can be, you know, overwhelming. But if I stay on the diet, I don't have any of the symptoms associated with that. So no one's, I sleep like a baby now. I don't get the herpes. I don't get the headaches. I don't get the car sickness. I could actually read a book in the back seat of a car, which is a wonderful thing. So it's really changed my life.
So when you talk about the herpes, that's the herpetiform?
Herpes, the herpes simplex that you get.
Herpes simplex. That's another symptom that goes...
Absolutely, yeah. The dermatitis is a different thing. That's an external thing on the arms.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes on other parts of the body. I never had that symptom. But that can very often be the presenting symptom for some people.
The dermatitis herpetiformis, is that how
right.
I pronounce
right.
it? Right.
Right.
And actually, one of our co-authors
has
it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's from that.
Right.
And
The GI symptoms are the most common ones.
Right. That's what people think of with celiac disease.
And what we think is that, and what the research seems to indicate, is that that's the ones that are diagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
It's that when you have the odd symptoms that people don't think about it. Mm-hmm. I just recently was talking to a friend who was diagnosed with celiac not so long ago, and she has a daughter who all of a sudden is, I guess she's around 20, and started having panic attacks. So I told her, I said, she needs to be checked for celiac disease. She said, well, why would this be causing panic attacks? She stands at the top of the stairs and can't walk downstairs. All of a sudden, not all the time, it just comes and goes. I said, just do me a favor, ask your doctor to check her for celiac disease, and she has celiac disease.
You know, and it's very interesting, Eileen, that you should bring that out, because, again, there are presenting symptoms that you're just not looked at as possibly having celiac disease. I have had a horrific dental history from the age of 2. My parents couldn't understand, out of 5 children, you know, why I was constantly in the dentist's office. I did everything I was supposed to do. They called it milk teeth, you know. But I had many dental procedures, very painful and expensive, to say the least. But nobody ever bothered to look to see what was my problem with my teeth. I also was diagnosed with osteopenia, severe osteopenia, at a very young age. And they're saying they don't connect the dots with a lot of the symptoms that they
have. Right. But I'm wondering with these wide, you know, varying symptoms from a panic disorder to problems, dental problems, the GI, I mean, the GI is classic, but these others, migraine, headaches, what, you know, is there some common element when, if, you know, at what point would someone say, I should get tested for celiac? Is it, you know, everyone who has a migraine headache? It just makes it so hard to figure out who to really check, and how is that done?
And it is very hard, which is why celiac goes so often undiagnosed.
Right, right.
They don't put those things together. But what I tell my students, because I teach nursing students, is first of all, look at the patient and talk to the patient. Mm-hmm. I had an old family doctor years ago told me, if you listen to a patient long enough, they'll tell you what's wrong with them.
Right.
And as patients start telling you all these vague, unrelated symptoms, and you start thinking, what the heck is going on? You have this, you have that. Mm-hmm. You know, why is this happening? They should be checked. And then start thinking about, does anybody else in your family have these symptoms? I mean, there's a couple clear indications. For instance, if you have thyroid disease, if you have diabetes type 1, then you should be tested and on an ongoing basis to see if celiac or will develop. If you have celiac disease, then they watch you for type 1 diabetes. They watch you for thyroid disease. So that triumvirate, you really kind of know that they go together. But again, if you listen to a patient and start thinking about what are the symptoms, and maybe they're not GI right away, or maybe they have GI and they don't think about it. I remember when I was diagnosed, I was saying to my sisters, well, you know, I didn't have GI symptoms, and they both looked at me and they said, are you kidding? You've had a stomach ache your whole life. I probably did, but I felt like, well, doesn't everybody?
Right, that was the
norm. You know, I was so used to it.
Right.
I didn't even think about it. But if you really start talking to patients and start realizing you've got this and you've got that and they don't, what's going on here? And since celiac is easily diagnosed by a blood test, if they have a distant relative or if they happen to be of European descent, that really puts them at very high risk. Mm-hmm. And we're learning more and more that other nationalities and other races are having more incidence of it as they start to, start to increase their intake of wheat products. We're seeing more and more celiac in other populations as well. And it's also probably been there, but nobody's ever thought of that, and nobody's ever tested them for it. So it's been there, but nobody realized it. So, but if you are of a European background or and then you have these vague symptoms, start thinking about, well, what does it have in common? What can we possibly test you for? And so, like I said, it's a blood test, so it's easily to do.
Yeah. And again, just to say a little bit more about what Eileen mentioned, when my husband was diagnosed, that was the one factor that I did remember how long he took with him, asking him question after question and repeating the questions again, to come up with this diagnosis. So I find a lot of times, because there are 300 presenting symptoms, I feel that maybe we latch on to the one big presenting symptom, and then what we do is try to correct that problem instead of really digging in to see, are there other symptoms connected with this that, perhaps we need to investigate further.
People may end up having that one symptom controlled, but it's really just symptom control because they are not seeing what's the actual underlying problem.
Which is the one thing that's totally recommended. You don't treat symptoms. You treat the disease. Right. But with celiac disease, people tend to treat the symptoms. Mm-hmm. I know 6 or 7 people who have lactose intolerance, and I keep telling them, watch. Think about that, which is what one of the things we're hoping with this article. If you are lactose intolerant, which is a very often common presenting symptom for celiac disease, if you have lactose intolerance and you're young, start thinking about what else is going on. Do you have other things that are going on? Because quite often, I don't think that I would have been diagnosed except my brother had been diagnosed.
Right.
And I think he was diagnosed because his granddaughter almost died. She was 18 months old, failure to thrive, and her hair started falling out. And finally, she stopped eating, probably because it hurt.
Right.
And they took her to the doctor, and my niece said they walked into this pediatric GI doctor. He took one look at her and said, she has celiac disease. And sure enough, she did. And that child now has Hashimoto's thyroiditis, and they're watching her for diabetes. So, but I don't think that my brother would have been diagnosed or I would have been diagnosed. And I know that I have a cousin who was diagnosed about 2 years after me, and she's a school teacher, and she said she would notice every time she ate a sandwich, she'd be doubled up in class the next day, within an hour or so. And she said it never would have occurred to her if we had not been diagnosed. So what we're hoping is that people can start thinking about, if you have these vague things, it's not age.
Because so many of the symptoms can be, people can put off to stress or being tired or changes with age or just so many different things.
Yeah. I have so much energy now that I did not have when I was 40 years old. Because I'm on a great diet. I feel probably 30 or 40 years younger than I did then. Yeah. I was tired all the time.
Yeah, it's amazing once you start the diet how much better you feel. You're so used to not feeling well.
Yeah.
That, you know, all of a sudden you start a gluten-free diet and, wow, I really feel good today. Mm-hmm. What happened mm-hmm. to me, you know?
And the brain fog disappeared.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about the gluten-free diet? Because I think a lot of people think that means, oh, I can't eat wheat products. And that, you know, so I should just give up bread and pasta and I'll be okay. But I think it's a lot more than that. And you really do need to be very, very strict. Is that correct?
Yes. It's 100%, I'm going to say denial, but that's not the word I'm looking for, exclusion of wheat gluten from your diet, wheat, oats, barley, and rye. And oats is questionable. Some people say you can have it, others say you can't, and it really depends. Unless you're going to be monitored, you know, over a period of time, you really should probably avoid the oats, although there is conflicting evidence about whether it is or not.
Well, what happens with the oats is that it's made in, sometimes made in the same factories that they manufacture wheat. So you have that cross-contamination problem with the oats.
Right.
So anybody that's truly gluten sensitive or has celiac disease, it's not something that it's so hard to remove it from your diet. You just don't want to even bother with taking the chance of it because of where it might have been made.
The hardest thing is eating out. If you're preparing your own food, it's especially for nurses, I found it really simple at home because it was just clean and dirty. You know, I felt like I was back in the hospital. I had my dirty stuff, I had my clean stuff. But when you eat out and you don't know what's in it, that's when it's difficult. And I hate to say it, but they lie. They tell you it's gluten-free, and then you get home and you have this terrible bellyache and you're wondering, what happened? Okay, what was in that? So I'm not afraid now. I have finally learned to speak up and said, okay, if this does have any wheat in it or is contaminated with any of these products, I'm going to probably be sick all over this table. And then they look at me and they go, okay, maybe you better not eat it. So, I mean, I've come down to that point because otherwise
I don't go to that extreme, but what I do say is that I am extremely allergic. And when a waiter or a waitress may hear that word, that you're extremely allergic to a product, their ears tend to go up a little bit. The other issue that comes up that I did want to bring up are the number of pizza parlors that are popping up all over the place advertising that they have gluten-free pizza. I would be very, very careful going into these pizza places. The gluten-free pizza may be a gluten-free pizza, but if it's not made totally separate from that they're making the other pizza, that cross-contamination is very high. So you really need to be careful with that.
And I recently called a chain which advertises that they have a gluten-free pizza, and finally after a long conversation it says, well, the crust is gluten-free. I'm like, what about the toppings? Mm-hmm. What about the oven? And they couldn't answer any of those questions. So I said, so that those of us who really need it gluten-free really can't eat this. Mm-hmm. And that's what it came down to. So you do have to be very careful and ask a lot of questions.
The labeling on products has gotten much better over the last couple of years. You'll see the sign that has GF on a lot of the foods. That is very helpful. It used to take me hours to go shopping because I would have to read 50 ingredients in something before I could really ascertain whether it was a gluten-free product or not. You have to be very concerned with things like natural flavorings, artificial flavorings, what is hidden in those. So GF is very welcoming now to help as far as shopping and making gluten-free products.
There seems to be more awareness about if maybe not even about celiac disease, but certainly the idea of the gluten-free, because I see that everywhere. They even, we just across the street from me, they opened a gluten-free bakery, a cupcake place, mm-hmm. and you see that gluten-free everywhere. Is that, do you think that is a, it's kind of like one of those kind of hot things that happen, like, oh, now everyone's avoiding gluten, or is it increased awareness about celiac disease? Or
we reduced sodium, we reduced fat, so now we're going to reduce gluten. It seems to be the newest fad.
Right,
and unfortunately,
right.
A lot of people who don't need to be on a gluten-free diet think that it's a style, you know, a stylish thing to do, and that they'll be healthier if they do. And actually, they're probably better off if they ate the gluten if they're not allergic to it,
mm-hmm.
because sometimes it's hard to get some of the nutrients that you need through gluten-free products. Not that wheat necessarily is a great product. It's a cheap product that feeds much of the world.
Right.
But they're finding more and more, and the literature is starting to talk about it, though, is wheat actually a product that we can't tolerate.
Mm-hmm.
Because in countries like Africa and in some of the Asian countries where they haven't had wheat before, but as they started to eat more and more of it, they're starting to have a higher incidence of celiac disease. So, and that's even in you know, pure races. So it's not just because of intermarrying and other genes from other races. So that's something we'll probably know about in the next 5 or 10 years as more and more research is done. So.
Also, Karen, I just wanted to mention when you had mentioned the gluten-free bakery products in the bakery with the other products that are not gluten-free. I actually tried that recently because there was a bakery that advertised that, and I was sorry I did. Again, the cross-contamination is very high in places like that, just like the pizza.
Right. This actually is a bakery. This is a gluten-free bakery. Like, that's all it has.
Right. And that is
indeed, I can't speak to the purity of it, but that's all that they have there are gluten-free products, cupcakes. Primarily, so.
I wouldn't be surprised if somebody in that family, even the owner or mm-hmm. one of their children, has celiac
yeah.
disease, and what they realize is they can't find it elsewhere, so they're going to develop it themselves.
Right.
Every instance I've had when I go to a specialty store like that, either the owner or a family member has it, and they've developed it, and I frequent quite a few of them.
Right.
But again, as Marianne is right, you have to be really, really, really cautious. You have to go in and talk to them, make sure they understand it.
Right.
And it's very interesting because they love to feed you, because they know how hard it is to find something like that, and they're so excited when they can give you something you haven't had in
right.
a very long time.
Right. And I also find it interesting because this is New York City where I live, and the real estate, you know, the rent or whatever on that little shop, I'm sure, is astronomical. So there must be enough of a demand for this, you know, those kind of products for them to even consider opening that store. And
celiac disease affects 1 in 133 people.
Right, and it seems to be increased, the incidence of it. I don't know if it's necessarily the incidence is increasing or is it just increased awareness and people are getting diagnosed more often than they did.
They don't know the answer to that.
Right.
There's been a supposition about both.
Right.
We're not sure, but hopefully people are being diagnosed when they have it because it is life changing.
And I think as more and more people are documenting histories in their families and things like that, there's been increased awareness. I know in my family because I have my mother's brother was actually diagnosed with celiac disease, which was interesting. Didn't think too much about it. My mother passed away from sarcoidosis. She probably did have it.
Right.
One of the things I remember growing up was my grandmother calling saying, ask your mother what her weight is today. Mm-hmm. So all of these things are now coming back to mm-hmm. me. That, you know, this certainly is a genetic line, you know, in the family. And, you know, people look at me and they say, what are the chances that you could be married to somebody who has the same problem you have? And I said, well, we're both 100% Irish. Chances are very good. It was unfortunate for our son, but...
And It's interesting. A friend of my sister's actually is a school nurse in a high school, and she said a couple weeks ago, and she got, you know, all the paperwork for the students, and she was kind of rolling her eyes and saying, "Oh, the hot disease this year is celiac. All the high school students have celiac." And I said, "Well, you know, we're doing an article on that." And there is a lot more incidence than we realize. And so, I wonder how much of it is, you know, people who are getting diagnosed with celiac, and then, like you say, sometimes it, things kind of become the hot diagnosis. So,
And I'm sure that is happening. But you, if you truly have celiac disease, when you go on that diet, as Marianne said, it is life-changing.
Right.
Within a month, I started to feel better. Within 6 weeks, I was like, oh, my gosh. I didn't really realize how bad I felt until I didn't feel that sick anymore.
And the diet may be difficult to follow, but at the same time, it's not taking heavy-duty medications and going through surgeries. It's this straightforward way that, like you say, that can change somebody's life once they get that diagnosis.
Right. Karen, I've been living with this with my husband for 15 years. We are in a much better place right now when it comes to gluten-free food.
Right.
The availability of it is, and you know, I'm finding a lot of things that actually taste good. I mean, 15 years ago, they didn't taste very good, you know. They really have improved upon the gluten-free products. So it's much easier now if you have to be on that diet, I find.
It really is. And, it's worth the trade-off because you feel so good. I know I keep saying that, but you can't imagine, you know, how different you feel. You just feel like you're finally alive.
And I would imagine that, you know, what are the long-term sequelae if this isn't treated, if you continue to, you know, eat the wheat and have all the inflammatory processes going on?
Right. Well, it depends. For instance, I think I wrote in the article, like, my hemoglobin was 8, and I was suicidal. I think if I hadn't been diagnosed, I might very well have committed suicide. Mm-hmm. I used to drive down the parkway thinking how I could do this, mm-hmm. and only thinking about my family stopped me.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, if it's not treated, you will have many more diseases. Interestingly, there's been some literature that shows that for some people it's almost protective, because you've been so malnourished for so long, you haven't built up the cholesterol and the other things that happen during midlife. So some celiacs are actually healthier as they get to old age because they haven't had all those things that happen to the rest of their family, you know, during the middle years. Like, I'm 70, and I don't take any medications at all. My brothers and sisters take 4 or 5. So it's in a sense, I'm better than they are. But, again, I was diagnosed. I don't know what would have happened, you know, down the
right.
road.
Well, what's interesting, too, is what they're saying is if you are not diagnosed prior to the age of 50, all of a sudden, at the age of 50, you start feeling the ramifications of not being on this diet for so many years. And that is exactly what happened with my husband, with the anemia, the 10-pound weight loss, all of a sudden the GI symptoms, he had no energy. You know, I mean, I was frightened. I thought maybe he had some kind of terminal illness because he changed so rapidly. And again, in my family, most of us were in our 50s when all of a sudden we started presenting with symptoms that were really presenting symptoms that we needed to get treatment for and then find out, you know, what was the underlying cause.
And when somebody is diagnosed, I mean, this is something really, though, that you've had all your life.
Correct.
Right? Right? Mm-hmm. Because it's because of what is actually the underlying, what's causing the celiac is not something that all of a sudden happens at 50.
You have the underlying cause in that you have the gene.
Right.
Have it. But the actual disease is, and they're not really sure what happens, but there is an environmental trigger. Something happens that all of a sudden the body starts attacking itself.
Right.
And you develop this autoimmune disease, and they're not really sure what that is. They don't really know yet what's going on and what happens there. But you do, in a sense, have it from birth because it is genetically, you know, transferred.
That's interesting, especially with the increased incidence. You wonder if that's a part of the increased incidence, that whatever these environmental triggers are, that there's...
Well, something happens, and they're not sure, again, right, what it is, but that all of a sudden the gluten starts acting, the body starts reacting differently to gluten, something you may have eaten your whole life. But again, you also talk to many celiacs who were not big bread eaters, were not pasta eaters their whole life. You just avoided them for one reason or another. And is it because that made you sick and that put off some of those symptoms because you just sit in and say, I don't feel good when I eat that. I used to call it Sunday morning stomach when we used to have buns and rolls for breakfast on Sunday. And I always had this Sunday morning stomach.
Yeah, and so people will begin to avoid those foods, and that could be something that happens even when you're very young without thinking about it.
That happened to me when I was in my teens and my early 20s. I kept getting what they call gastritis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they would treat me for gastritis, and they'd say, stay away from this kind of food and that kind of food. But that's really not what it was.
Right. So what is your... The biggest take-home message to nurses?
When somebody presents with something vague, keep talking to them. You don't usually have just one symptom. Most celiacs that we've talked to have 3 or 4 or 5 symptoms. And just talk to somebody when you've got something that's going on for somebody that takes very good care of the health but has frequent mouth problems, not necessary cavities, but gum problems, even though they're very careful about how they, care for their mouth. If somebody has osteopenia and doesn't have any reason to have that, if somebody is anemic and doesn't have any reason to have that, and then if they have 2 or 3 of them, start thinking about what could possibly be going on here.
Yeah, but I think that, again, a very comprehensive history, physical, trying to pull out some information from the patient because there are so many vague symptoms, and trying to group them together, with maybe some type of a genetic history. And then be their advocate. Speak with the physician on their behalf and say, have you thought about possibly testing this person for celiac? They have, X amount of symptoms, and there is a family history. So, I know I've done a lot of that within my family and friends that, and they have been diagnosed, and it's just because they start talking to me about these symptoms, and I know, the symptoms, like I know my name. So, I really encourage them to get checked, which is why, my sister was checked and kept pushing. So I think that it's really important, that communication, that listening, trying to pull the things together, and then being a patient advocate.
Great. Yeah, I agree with that advocacy piece. Okay, well, thank you, both of you. This was really interesting. You have such a good insight coming from both a professional, as nurses yourselves, and then as somebody who has gone through all of the challenges that celiac disease presents. So I really appreciate taking the time today to talk to us about this, and I encourage everyone to read the article that's coming out in October, Celiac Disease, a Medical Puzzle. Thank you, Dr. Tohill and Marianne.
Thank you.
Thank you, Karen.
Yep.